Cincinnati firefighters are unhappy. A survey found low morale with one firefighter saying, "Our house is on fire." You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today, we'll hear about those survey results. Plus, Procter & Gamble's plan to cut thousands of jobs globally, the latest plan to fix Ohio's unemployment compensation system, and how Cincinnati is looking to address food insecurity and gun violence. Joining me now to kick off our weekly news review is Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter Dan Horn. Welcome back, Dan.
Hi, Lucy.
Thanks for being here. Dan, what's this culture survey of Cincinnati firefighters?
So this was a survey done last fall. It looks like September and October. And basically it was a survey they offered up to all fire department employees, most of which are firefighters, about 850 of the 950 so employees there are firefighters. And the goal was to kind of gauge morale, to gauge any concerns firefighters might have. And they found quite a bit. The big issue seems to be the relationship between the line employees and management. Throughout the survey, the results showed that two and three of every three firefighters were saying that they were not satisfied with transparency and decision-making. They didn't feel there was adequate trust between line employees and management. They didn't feel that they were encouraged to provide input to management for changes. And they also felt that discipline and promotions weren't fair.
Is this related at all to the firing of former fire chief Michael Washington?
In a way, Mike Washington was fired in 2023 after, I think, just 22 months on the job. At the time, city manager Cheryl Long said that he was fired because of some of these very issues that he was failing to address in the fire department, and also for insubordination, because she said that he had been interfering with the a program that was being run through the fire department to try to improve conditions for women firefighters. There had been complaints about harassment and facilities and that sort of thing. And she had said he was standing in the way of that. He denies that. He denies all of this. And I will note, too, that at the time he was fired, we went through his personnel file, and there were no mentions of those sorts of things in his file, no complaints or warnings or anything like that. That's not to say that her concerns weren't legitimate, but they had not been in his file. They hadn't been something that was logged for any length of time. But he denies all of those allegations.
Yeah, and he's currently suing the city, right?
He is. He is. And one of the other things she had criticized him for was failing to do a culture survey like the one we're talking about today. His position was that I was trying to do it. COVID was going on. I was trying to work with the city to come up with a plan to do it, and that it didn't happen.
How many firefighters responded to this culture survey, and what do we know about the demographics of the people who responded?
Demographics roughly match the demographics of the fire department itself. It's about 25% Black, about 10% women, but the overall participation rate was pretty low. It was only about 20%. So that was an issue. It was an issue that the firm that conducted the survey, Matrix, recognized. It was also an issue the city recognized. And so after they got the results, they went through a series of focus groups as well to try to expand input from firefighters, give them another opportunity. They also extended the deadline to participate in the actual survey several times too, and still only capped out at around 20%.
Your reporting points out that firefighters who responded to the survey had an opportunity to write down some thoughts, and that one of the comments one firefighter left was, as I said earlier, "Our house is on fire." What are some of the other comments that firefighters wrote in these surveys?
Well, some of them were quite long and thoughtful and very specific. Some mentioned specific managers, some mentioned very specific issues in some detail. Most were relatively short and complained about broader issues. There were things that said, like, "We are miserable, no one cares," that kind of thing. There were others, though, that said they just felt there were some structural problems that needed to be addressed and that they were fixable. So it really ran the gamut from people who felt, the department's a complete mess to people who felt, you know, we're making progress, things are okay. But the overall upshot of the survey was, at least among those who participated, was that there are some pretty serious problems that need to be addressed.
Well, I was going to ask you if it sounds like the department's problems have gotten any better, but it sounds like it's kind of a mixed bag in terms of what the firefighters said.
Yeah, well, it's hard to gauge if things have improved since the survey was done. You know, the survey was done last fall, and the city hasn't released it yet. We, you know, obtained a copy of this when we wrote the story this week. They say that they are trying to address this by coming up with a series of action plans based on the survey results. They're working with the firm that conducted the survey to do some of that. The chief, Frank McKinley, the current chief, had said to us via email that they have implemented a few things that they're hoping address some of this: more regular meetings with union and employee groups, tours of firehouses, that sort of thing, to improve communications. But beyond that, we don't really have a good gauge on what the city's plan is. They say there is one, and they say it's coming, but we haven't seen it yet.
One of the things that you just mentioned a few minutes ago was that the former fire chief was, you know, was directed to have these programs related to women firefighters. What did this survey have to say when it comes to diversity and opportunities for employees of color and women? I mean, it sounds like there were some mixed feelings about that, too.
Yeah, that was interesting because while it does give you a demographic breakdown of participants, it does not tell you how individual, the race or gender of individual responses. It doesn't break responses down by gender or race. So you can't tell exactly how white firefighters feel versus minority firefighters. You can't really tell how men firefighters feel versus women firefighters by the data alone, but the extended answers that were offered up do give you some clues. And what it looks like is that you see that it depends on perspective. Everybody might be complaining about race in promotions or gender in promotions, but from reading the comments, it's pretty clear that there are white firefighters who feel they're being discriminated against because DEI is being overemphasized, and that there are black firefighters and women firefighters who feel that white men still have an advantage over them in promotions. So it's hard to gauge exactly how that breaks down, but you can tell that there's general dissatisfaction, but the reasons for that dissatisfaction are very different depending on who's talking.
How has the city manager responded to this?
Well, we got an email response from her office regarding our questions, or at least some of them. Basically, she says we're addressing this. She said that it was premature for us to write the story, that, you know, the data is just that right now, and we don't have all the information, and they're gathering more information, and they're going to try to put together, as I said, some action plans to deal with this. Again, what we don't know what those are exactly. So beyond that, we don't know. But their main point was that it's premature to draw conclusions from the data that we have right now.
Did you hear anything from the mayor or any other city officials about all this?
No, my colleague Scott Wortman, who covers City Hall for us, reached out to a number of folks at the city, and other than the city manager's office and the fire chief's office via email, we didn't get responses really from anyone. Part of that may be they haven't seen the information, or they just don't want to talk about it yet. But basically, it's pretty quiet over there when it comes to this.
Okay. And as you said, I guess they're working on a plan, and we'll see what comes of that. Well, Dan, thank you. Yeah, I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer investigative reporter Dan Horn. Thanks so much for your time today, Dan.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Sure. From the fire department to the Fortune 500, we turn to Procter & Gamble's announcement this week that the company plans to cut thousands of jobs globally. Joining me now to explain is Cincinnati Business Courier Managing Editor Andy Brownfield. Thanks for being here, Andy.
Hey, Lucy. Thanks for having me.
So how many jobs will P&G be cutting?
So Procter & Gamble presented at the Deutsche Bank Consumer Conference in Paris just 2 days ago. Actually, I guess it would be yesterday in American time. And Chief Financial Officer André Schulten announced at that conference that they're going to cut 7,000 non-manufacturing jobs over the next 2 years, which amounts to about 15% of its non-factory workforce.
Do we know where the cuts will happen or if any of them will be in Greater Cincinnati?
So we don't. They're not breaking down the number of cuts by region or job site at this time, but Cincinnati is one of the, if not the largest concentration of non-manufacturing jobs for P&G. I mean, downtown's its corporate headquarters, and of the 108,000 total employees it has worldwide, about 30,000 are in the U.S., and 11,000 of those are local employees. So while it's hard to imagine a universe in which headquarters jobs in downtown Cincinnati are not impacted, it has been investing locally in its headquarters as of late. I mean, P&G, we reported last month, is investing $13 million in upgrades to its downtown headquarters, which includes $8 million that it's pouring into its first floor fitness center and upgrades to its existing cafe, as well as another $5 million to its parking garage, which is going to go to things like replacing escalators with elevators.
Interesting. How is the company explaining the need for these cuts?
So they're saying that it's not a cost-cutting measure, but an attempt to make roles broader, teams smaller, and work more efficient. And they're going to leverage digitization and automation to aid in that. They didn't say AI, but that sounds an awful lot like AI. And, you know, after saying it's not a cost-cutting measure, they said the cost of these cuts, which is actually happening in conjunction with cuts to its portfolio of products, the cost of those cuts will be in the range of $1 billion to $1.6 billion before tax.
So it'll cost them money to make these cuts, I assume, because they'll be giving employees packages and that sort of thing?
I think what they meant by that was the cost savings.
Oh, I see. Okay, that was business talk. I missed that. Could the company, you mentioned the portfolio of brands, will this also include getting rid of some brands potentially?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, it could entail exiting some product categories, some brands, some product forms in individual markets. They could divest some brands. They haven't released any details now, but P&G said that more information will be shared in the months ahead. And this is straight out of the classic P&G playbook. It's easy to forget, but more than 15 years ago, P&G was on pretty shaky ground in the mid to early 2010s. It's got about 108,000 employees worldwide now. That was 124,000 in 2010. And a portfolio of 165 brands, and not all of which were really high performers. I mean, remember when P&G owned Pringles? So former CEO A.G. Laffley, he really spearheaded this push to winnow the brand pool down to its most productive, its highest performing brands. And that was finished under former CEO David Taylor. But current CEO John Moeller, like he had his fingerprints on this all the way back to 2012. He devised a plan to cut $10 billion in costs over 5 years. That included a reduction in headcount by 5,700 jobs. And when that happened faster than expected, it resulted in another 5-year plan to cut another $10 billion. So it brought the workforce down to 92,000 from the 124,000, which was its lowest point since at least 2003.
How have P&G sales been doing?
So P&G sales have been growing. Its most recent quarterly results, revenue declined 2% to just under $20 billion, but they still plan full year growth. It's just going to be smaller than it was originally predicted. So the company predicted 5 to 7% growth for this year, and their fiscal year ends at the end of June. But they cut that last month to about 2 to 4%. And that's due to a mix of tariffs impact and the weaker economic outlook, according to CFO Andre Schulten.
And can you talk a little bit more about the kind of impact the Trump administration's tariffs are having on the company? Is that a pretty big deal for P&G?
It's a billion-dollar deal for P&G. I mean, P&G said that the impact of these tariffs could be at least $1 billion or more during that earnings call in April. They said that it's probably going to result in higher prices for P&G in the new fiscal year, which starts July 1. And because of the way P&G's manufacturing is structured, it's going to mitigate some of the impact of that tariffs to some extent. P&G tends to make products where they're sold. I mean, for example, P&G invested more than $10 billion since 2017 in the U.S. on production facilities, and they created about 6,000 domestic jobs through that. But that being said, 52% of its revenue comes from outside the U.S. And, you know, on top of tariffs, there's also instability, the conflict in Ukraine, that's having an impact on P&G as well, Russia. So it's not just the tariffs, but a mixture of economic headwinds that the company is facing.
You were talking before about that reorganization of brands that A.G. Lafley started. And if I'm remembering correctly, there was a real focus on billion-dollar brands. Do you have any guesses about which brands might be on the chopping block? Are there any that are weaker than others in the portfolio these days?
I don't. I don't have my crystal ball out to see what they've
got. Okay, fair enough.
P&G, like I said, they're no stranger to reorganization and to,
streamlining, restructuring, all those things.
Yeah, it's efficiency. Mm-hmm. So I mean, there was a big fight about that almost a decade ago, if you remember, when Nelson Peltz launched a really expensive proxy fight. He spent $25 million attempting to get a board seat on P&G. And P&G spent $35 million fighting him. They ultimately won, but they did give him a board seat. And when they won that proxy fight, they still ended up implementing a most significant leadership shakeup since 1999. So Peltz, if you remember, he wanted to break P&G up into three standalone businesses, but the company ultimately shrunk its 10 global business lines down to six, each with its own chief executive reporting to the CEO. And, divested brands as part of that process as well.
How did the markets react to this news from P&G?
So it's interesting. In pre-market trading, P&G's stock was actually up a little bit. But then I think when news of this more widely spread, it dipped to, I think, about $2.50 throughout the day. But as of today, the stock's actually up. It's up nearly 1% or $1.50 to $164 per share. And, you know, in terms of the year, it's still below the $176 high it was in March, but it is definitely recovered from the cratering that happened after that disappointing earnings report in April.
I know that's a stock that a lot of people in greater Cincinnati hold. When will we know more details? You mentioned these cuts are going to be made over a couple of years. Any thoughts on when we'll know if any of these job cuts or how many would be local or any other details?
No, P&G's playing it pretty close to the vest here. But from what I've read, the company isn't one to do kind of warn notice style mass layoffs, but really let these cuts happen through attrition. So as people leave the company, they just won't backfill those roles, or they'll might offer buyout early retirement packages to some people who are getting close to retirement age anyway. So I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see some of these, you know, companies are required under federal and state law to report mass layoffs to the state. And I'm not sure if we're going to see a WARN notice come through with P&G from this.
Makes sense. Well, I have been talking with Cincinnati Business Courier Managing Editor Andy Brownfield. Thanks so much for your time today, Andy.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, Ohio's unemployment compensation system needs an overhaul. We'll hear about the latest attempt to fix it. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Ohio's unemployment compensation system has been a mess for years. What will it take to fix it? Joining me now to talk about the latest effort is USA Today Network Ohio Bureau reporter Laura Bischoff. Thanks for being here, Laura.
Hi, Lucy.
So as simply as you can explain it, what is wrong with Ohio's unemployment system?
Not enough money comes in and too much money goes out.
Wow, that was very good. That's very simple. How long has the Unemployment Compensation Fund been in this kind of trouble?
Well, this system started during the Great Depression about 95 years ago. And usually after an economic downturn, there's effort to raise more taxes to replenish the money that goes out during a recession in unemployment checks. But in recent economic downturns, the amount that they've put in has been little or not enough. And as a result, the fund is chronically underfunded. It went broke in 2008, 2009, following the economic downturn then, and Ohio had to borrow more than $3 billion from the federal government. And then again, after the COVID pandemic, Ohio had to borrow, I think, like $1.5 billion. And now the projections are that it will be insolvent again in 2032 if there's no simple, if there's no fix made.
Why has it been so hard to fix?
Well, it's funny because it's not that hard. You know, it's cut benefits, raise taxes, or do a combo platter of the two. And the what makes it hard is that the unions have dug in their heels and the employers have dug in their heels. So neither side wants to shoulder the burden or even share the burden. So it's been just like a merry-go-round where they just keep rinsing and repeating and trying to get this done.
So all unpopular choices. Well, you reported that a state lawmaker introduced a bill this week to try to address the problem. What would his bill do?
So, yeah, State Representative Bob Peterson, he's from Fairfield County, and he's tried to fix this in the past. His fix is not comprehensive. Really, it would just add 2 years of solvency to the system. So it's a little bit of a kick the can down the road, but with the hopes that while getting agreement on this little fix, they could keep working toward a bigger fix. So his little fix is to raise the taxable base wage up to $9,500 of your earnings, up from the current $9,000. And that would raise almost $24 million a year in additional money into the system. And it would also require employees who work for businesses that have a negative rating, meaning the company takes more money out of the system than pays into it because they have a lot of routine layoffs. This would probably be very typical, like in the construction industry. So that the employees would have to contribute 0.14% of 1%, like just a small little itty bitty piece. And this would raise $25 million a year. It's unclear whether or not they're going to be able to get agreement on these two changes. It sounds like labor and business is okay with each of these little changes, although they don't like them. And Peterson said, he was asking in committee the other day whether or not this would be continue as a standalone bill or if it would get wrapped into the budget. And he said he's amenable to either one.
I want to make sure I understand those two pieces that you just outlined. So when you're talking about the taxable base wage, that means any wages above that amount don't get taxed for the unemployment system. Is that what that means?
Yeah, that's my understanding. So, you know, a lot of other states tax like the first $14,000 or $15,000, and Ohio has been traditionally pretty low. And that's like the big crux of the problem in that, you know, the employers don't want to pay taxes, more employment taxes for this unemployment system. And they would prefer to see the number of weeks of benefits be cut from 26 weeks to 20 or fewer. And the labor side says that's a non-starter. We will fight tooth and nail over the number of weeks.
And this proposal you mentioned to require employees who work for a company with a negative rating, meaning these companies take more out of the system than they contribute, that the employees would have to contribute 0.14% of their paycheck. Do employees who work for a company with a negative rating, do they already contribute part of their paycheck to this system?
No, I don't think that they do. I think this would be kind of a new mechanism. There's about 250,000 employers that pay into the system, and about 15,000 of them are negatively rated. So the idea would be, you know, spreading the pain on the employer, in the businesses, the employers that really put more demands on the system, rather than making employers who, you know, don't have a lot of layoffs also share in the pain.
But this would essentially require employees to pay more into the system if they work at a place where lots of people regularly lose their jobs?
That's correct.
Okay, huh. And how has the, you mentioned that that both sides seem kind of okay with this. Has there been any more detailed reaction from the business community to this proposal?
Well, it's interesting. They just introduced the bill, I think on Monday, and they had the first hearing on the bill on Tuesday. So it's still kind of in the baby steps in terms of the legislative process. The Ohio Chamber of Commerce testified saying, you know, they'd like to see even more changes. They want a more of a comprehensive fix. And again, they suggested reducing the number of weeks that employees could receive benefits. And then the Trades Union Act Ohio director, he said, you know, cutting the benefits would hurt our industry and the supply of workers, and we oppose a reduction in the number of weeks. So even if they agree on this, on these 2 points that Representative Peterson wants in his bill, they still seem like they're pretty far apart on the bigger fix.
Sure, because as you said, even if this bill were to pass, it would only extend solvency by a couple of years.
That's right. And, you know, anytime there's an economic downturn, the demand on the unemployment compensation fund goes up significantly. And so if we have a recession like later this year, the insolvency could come sooner.
You mentioned that this is kind of in the early stages of the legislative process. What's next with this?
They'll have another hearing next, I think Tuesday or Wednesday of next week. And again, the state budget bill, already cleared the House. The Senate put its stamp on it and is considering it. And you know, the budget bill is kind of like a moving train where people try to hop on all of their different ideas and earmarks and policy changes. So this is something that could get attached to the budget bill. And the budget bill has to, you know, it's supposed to be signed into law by June 30th because the new fiscal year for the state starts on July 1st.
Well, let's talk now about Avery's Law. Tell us what this law would do and who it's named for.
So the bill is named for Avery Russell. She's a 12-year-old kid in Columbus. Almost a year ago this month, she was attacked by two pit bulls while she was in Reynoldsburg outside of Columbus on a play date with a friend. She was left with terrible facial disfigurement. She lost both ears. She suffers from a lot of PTSD. She testified in favor of the bill on Tuesday at the State House, really showed a lot of poise and guts to come forward with her story and tell all these adults in the room that that Ohio law could do a lot better for victims. The law is sponsored by State Representative Kevin Miller. He's a former state trooper from Newark. And he thinks that like owners of dangerous or vicious dogs should have to be required to buy $100,000 in liability insurance, and that they should have to secure their dogs when an invitee is present on their property. So in the case of Avery, when she went on a play date with her friend, and then the friend's mom took the girls over to her cousin's house, the cousin should have locked the dogs up in a secure location so that, you know, new people visiting the property wouldn't have contact with the dangerous dogs. And the dogs that had attacked her did have a history of biting other kids. A bunch of other changes to the bill as well.
Yeah. You mentioned that Avery told her story to lawmakers this week. Tell us a little bit more about her testimony.
Well, she said, you know, she wants to provide a message of hope for all kids who go through trauma, that, you know, you can be you, you can get back, and you can get through what you're experiencing. I thought that was really powerful. And she also says that she thinks that, you know, dog owners should just be more responsible for their pets. That, you know, she never thought that going into the house in Reynoldsburg to use the bathroom, something so ordinary, could turn into such a traumatic and life-altering event for her.
What is Ohio's current law when it comes to dog bites and dog attacks? I know we've talked about this on the program before, but remind us what happens to the dogs and the owners of the dogs who are involved in attacks like this?
The dog law is very confusing. It got rewritten in 2012, and there have been a number of different problems with it. One thing is that the dog law allows, if a dog does serious injury to somebody like Avery, there's no mandate to put the dog down. As a matter of fact, the dog owner of the dog that one of the two dogs got put down right away on site by the police officers, but the second dog survived and the owner is still fighting to get that dog back. Avery's law would make it so that if a dog does serious injury to a human being or kills someone, euthanasia would be mandated. Right now, under state law, a dog can kill someone and a judge may order euthanasia, but isn't required to order it. So the dog could be kept at home. And if it gets out and kills a second person, then the state law, the current law, says the dog has to be put down. It's called the two free kill provision.
And what about the owners of the dogs? What does state law currently say about what consequences for them?
It's interesting because like dog bites and failure to confine your dog, the fees and fines start at like $25. If you have a dangerous dog and it bites somebody, the fines are more significant and you might end up being faced with like a $250 fine and maybe a month in jail. But it's very rare to get to a felony in a dog case. There was the case in Pickaway County where the mother and son who owned these two dogs that killed their neighbor, they were charged with involuntary manslaughter and convicted and sentenced to at least, 14 years in jail, in prison.
And would Avery's law, and I apologize if you already mentioned this, but would it change penalties for dog owners too? I know you said it would change the law surrounding the dogs themselves.
Yes, the penalties would be increased. I can't cite you chapter and verse on the bill at this point. It's like 20 pages long.
Oh, that's okay.
But yeah, in general, it's going to increase the penalties. It's going to increase the requirements if you have a dangerous or vicious dog to keep it away from other people, buy liability insurance, and take other steps.
State lawmakers have pushed for changes to the law before. What kind of support do you think Avery's law has?
Well, it's interesting. I was talking to State Representative Cindy Abrams, who chairs the committee where the bill is pending. And she said this is a high priority. She wants to get a vote on it out of committee and to the House floor by the end of the month. So she said that there's a lot of support on her committee for it. Opponent testimony is coming up next week, so we'll see how that goes. But I think that this has probably got more of a chance to make it through into law than previous iterations. About 10 or 11 years ago, there was a really horrible fatality in Dayton, Kalonda Ritchie, and that spurred a string of six different lawmakers from the Dayton area to try to change the law, and none of them were successful. So we'll see where this one goes.
And you said that opponent testimony is next week. Huh? Is that kind of the next big step for this?
Yeah, they'll do opponent testimony, interested parties. This past week, Avery testified two men who were attacked. One guy was a ultra marathoner and he was running on some property, had stopped to take a drink of water, and three dogs appeared out of the woods and bit him six times. And then a letter carrier came forward and talked about his experience. And then also the dog wardens, the Ohio County Dog Wardens Association. They also came and testified in favor of the bill. I'm not sure who's going to oppose it. Typically, dog bills will get a lot of pushback from like pit bull groups or groups that are against euthanasia of animals. So we'll see if anybody comes forward to say that there's problems with this bill and to lay those out.
Yeah. Well, just to clarify, I know we've talked about this before, but Ohio does not have breed-specific legislation, right? It's based on dogs' behavior, not dog breeds.
Yeah, actually, in 2012, when they rewrote the law, they moved away from breed-specific legislation that really kind of targeted pit bulls and other certain breeds. And so now it's, you know, the focus is on the deed of the dog, not the breed of the dog.
Yep. Well, Laura, thank you. I've been talking with USA Today Network, Ohio Bureau reporter, Laura Bischoff. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, Cincinnati considers a new strategy to address food insecurity and gun violence. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Cincinnati Mayor Aftab Purval and City Manager Cheryl Long last month unveiled a $1 billion budget for the next two fiscal years for the city of Cincinnati. Now city council members are deciding whether to spend a small fraction of that money on an initiative to reduce food insecurity and gun violence. Joining me now to talk about the latest on the budget is WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Becca.
Thanks, Lucy. I know I'm your favorite because I'm last today.
I always save the best for last. So, Becca, Cincinnati City Council members are working on a new budget for the city. They talked this week about how much money will go to third-party organizations. How much money are we talking about, and can you walk us through that process a little bit?
Yeah, so the way that the city funds outside organizations is actually kind of complicated, and there are different rules depending on which kind of money we're talking about. So just as sort of a general overview, there are two main mechanisms for funding those third-party organizations. We have the Human Services Fund. That is where organizations apply to basically the United Way. It's managed by the United Way. And then there's an independent committee of folks appointed by the mayor who review those applications. They score them, and then they just give funds based on that score. That's what we're talking about this week. There is a separate sort of mechanism for this that will come up later in the budget process where the city manager recommends funding for organizations that have applied to the city directly with an application process, asking for certain grants for certain activities. And then the city manager recommends how much money she thinks should go to those organizations and which organizations. And city council has ultimate say. There is sort of this third unregulated bucket, I guess, where technically council can just decide to give money to people. So this year, the mayor has actually recommended several organizations that did not apply for funding either to the United Way from the Human Services Fund or directly to the city. But he has recommended some funding. Council has the option to either approve those or not approve them, and they could also decide on their own which organizations they want to support. So that was very complicated. I apologize.
No, there's a lot going on there. So these organizations that the mayor is recommending, are these organizations that just went to him, or are these organizations that he just found out about and thought, hey, I can, you know, this, you could do more good work if only you had this money?
Yeah, it's a mix of both. You know, when I asked the mayor about this a couple of weeks ago when they first unveiled the budget, the first draft of the budget, you know, he said some of the organizations are ones that, you know, he went to and said, hey, for example, there's a lot going on in the country right now related to immigration and deportations. And so certain immigration related organizations he sought out and said, could you use some city funding? They said yes. And so he's recommended them for funding.
How much of the city's budget does this represent, this money that goes to these outside third-party organizations?
Yeah, so it does vary a little bit year to year because some of this is a little bit more loosey-goosey. And apologies for the pun, I guess. No, I don't know if that's a pun.
I've heard it before. It's
I'm
okay.
Sure you have. I didn't mean to target you with that language.
Okay.
Some of it is a little bit more, you know, lack of process. And so that can change year to year. But when we're talking about the Human Services Fund, and we did get information this week about which organizations are likely to get funding from that, City Council has determined that that fund should represent about 1.5% of the city's general fund. Now, you mentioned a $1 billion budget. Most of that money is tied up in restricted funds for certain things, like we pay our rates to Greater Cincinnati Water Works. All of that money stays in Greater Cincinnati Water Works. So the general fund is much smaller. And then 1.5% of that is supposed to go to this Human Services Fund. This year, that's about $8.5 million. So that's the money that this independent committee reviews the applications, does the scores, and then this week they presented to council their recommendations for how to spend that money.
How big are the grants that go to these organizations?
This year, they're capped at about $200,000 each. Some of that is it's a little bit higher than it has been in the past. So one of the strategies that they talked about this year, and we say this year, we're talking on a biennial schedule. So really the last time this was funded or choices were made about this money was 2 years ago. So this cycle, one of the things they talked about was looking at organizations, deciding which ones they thought could spend the money most effectively, and fully funding how much they've asked for. Whereas in the past, like let's say three organizations each ask for $50,000, but only $100,000 is available. So they give a smaller amount to all three organizations. This year, the strategy was more, let's give two organizations as much as they asked for, because we trust that they know how much it's going to cost to actually run these programs.
There's also this impact award that's designed to really make a difference. Explain that award. I don't think it's been around for very long, and what the recommendation is for that this year.
Yeah, so this is the second budget cycle that the Impact Award has been around. It started 2 years ago. At that time, the Impact Award was like 33% basically of the Human Services Fund. It was a much larger amount of money. It was about $2 million. It went to strategies to end homelessness and several other organizations working to use data to prevent homelessness. This time around, they decided to lower the amount of the Impact Award. So it's still a significant amount of money, but it's only 10%. So it's about $850,000. Council had decided a couple of months ago that they wanted the Impact Award to address food insecurity and gun violence some way, kind of overlapping together. They got six applications from lots of different organizations. They were really looking for a group that was going to collaborate. So it wasn't just one organization, but that was going to bring together a lot of organizations in the nonprofit space to address this. So the one that's recommended for funding is led by Cincinnati Children's Hospital, but with many other organizations slated to be included in that. In order to qualify for this funding, they did have to address food insecurity in some of the neighborhoods that have the highest rates of gun violence. So we're not entirely sure which neighborhoods those will be yet, because the project that they pitched had to touch, I think, three or four of the like 10 neighborhoods with the highest rates of gun violence. We don't know yet exactly what that program is going to look like, because the pitch was a little bit more, not bare bones, but it's a blueprint for what it will eventually look like.
So is there, did they talk about this connection between food insecurity and violence? I mean, was there much discussion of that?
Not much discussion of that. So a lot of that was kind of fleshed out in when council decided that this was the topic they wanted to focus on with the Impact Award this year. But one of the things that they cite is research that shows that there's a high correlation between victims of gun violence, so people who are hit with bullets, and their reported rates of food insecurity. So there's a lot of overlap between that. And again, this is correlation, not necessarily causation, but the idea is food insecurity is a problem. And we know the neighborhoods that have the highest levels of gun violence in Cincinnati. And so this is a way to kind of address two issues at one time with a really targeted, kind of specifically targeted population to receive those services.
What's next with the budget? I mean, is this a process? I know we've been talking about how the state budget has to be passed by June 30th. Mm-hmm. Is that the same deadline for the city? And how much more work is there to do on this whole thing?
It is technically the same deadline for the city, although I think the state tends to go up until the deadline often. And city council, it's a smaller amount of money we're talking about here, and a lot fewer people that have to agree on it. The city council is aiming to finalize this process by June 18th. Which is a Wednesday. So there is still a lot of work to do. The city manager and the mayor have their proposals for how to spend the money. After all of that, so council can make changes to that, move things around. There is also about $1.8 million unallocated. This is kind of a strategy by the administration to say, like, here, you can spend this money. Don't make changes to what I've proposed. But there is still that $1.8 million that could be spent on any number of things. Council members are supposed to submit to the clerk today their proposals for what they would want to change or what to spend that money on. I just checked right before here, and I don't see any listed online yet, but those will probably be online later today. So then next week, we'll see some more like kind of substantive debate between council members. There are 9 of them. Any changes they make to the proposal or any proposals they make to spend money needs at least 5 votes to pass. Now, we should have a pretty good idea of what that will look like because they'll vote on a motion version of all of these changes, and then we'll kind of know what they're going to spend it on. But then the law department has to go back and draft an ordinance version of that and make sure it passes all of the legal rigmarole. And that's what they'll pass in the third week of June by June 18th.
That $1.8 million is really interesting. Is that basically each council member gets a couple $100,000 to...
Oh, wouldn't that be interesting? That's a great idea. Not quite, no. So basically, I expect, based on previous years, that each council member will have a plan for how they want to spend the full $1.8 million. And then they'll have to come to some compromise and come to an agreement. Now, it is likely that some council members are already talking to each other and saying, hey, go in with me on this motion. Let's go together and decide how we want to spend it. But no, they'll need 5 votes. But I think, you know, council wants to spend money, and this is their chance to do it. It is a pretty important process. So we'll see some of the discussion and the negotiations will take place kind of behind the scenes before we see the public motions. Some of it will happen on the floor of city council chambers next week, but we'll see what happens.
Are you expecting any major changes as the budget gets finalized over the next couple of weeks?
It's hard to predict that. I wouldn't say major changes, but this council has previously made some, you know, allocation differences. I did talk to the budget chair, Jeff Kramerding, about the fleet budget, for example, and how much is allocated for fleet. It's less than was allocated last year, but there's been a lot of talk at council this year about the need for fleet. There's a backlog, much like with preventative maintenance, there's a backlog. Separately, there's a backlog in fleet maintenance and replacement. So I expect Kramerding to propose a boost to the amount of funding for fleet replacement. And probably there will be support for that on council, given how much talk we've had about snowplows, for example, but also even just things like potholes and filling potholes. Those are all things that need fleet vehicles to operate. So that's my biggest thing I'm paying attention to. But I don't know. We'll see. This council could surprise me. I think there is a lot of money slated for street rehabilitation from the railroad funds. But I think this council may want to see even more of that because the costs are increasing. So we'll see.
Yeah. And in the past, I know there have been nonprofits who have been left out of the process who have kind of appealed to council members in the final weeks. Do you think that might be a possibility?
We have already seen some of that. The last public budget hearing was Tuesday evening, and we heard from several organizations that are not slated for funding. Interestingly, most of them were ones that applied to the Human Services Advisory Committee. So the fund that really council does have final say over that, but historically they accept the recommendations of the committee. And so it would be new. It would be surprising if council were to make changes to those allocations.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thank you so much for your time today, Becca.
Thank you, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez-Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening. Hope you get a donut today. It's National Donut Day.